Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Dominic Woodhouse from Mangrove Action Project. Hey, Dominic. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. And I'm super excited to learn more about you and the Mangrove Action Project. So I'd love for you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself. How did you first become interested in mangrove conservation? And what brought you to join Mangrove Action Project?
Well, an obvious start into 10 years in advertising was enough to put off anybody into that agency, the whole industry. Leaving advertising, I really wanted to try and do something social and socially useful. A friend of mine said, "What's your passion?" I would think that was the best career advice. My passion, I suppose, my great interest was trees, forests, that sort of thing. Just started reading more about all the different forest ecosystems, mountain forest, tropical rainforest, etc. Mangroves really appealed. It gave me the sorts of things that I wanted to do. Lots of learning. The science is still evolving, and it allowed me to go back to Southeast Asia, where I had worked previously in advertising and really enjoyed as a region, just not particularly that industry. And so just got further and further into it. And with Mangrove Action Project in 2005, gosh, that feels like a long time ago, and just been hanging around since then, I suppose.
It must have been such a different field back then, because when you say marketing, because this is something that I do on the side as well, I work in science communications, and right now the intersection of the availability of digital marketing and the cross-functionality that you can apply it through sciences and conservation. For example, even the show that we're on right now is a format of digital marketing. So it's interesting that you had that sway away from marketing directly into conservation. And then here's me kind of sitting at the intersection of that. I'd love for you to go into a bit of detail so our listeners know more about what mangroves are and why they're such a unique and important ecosystem.
So mangroves are a ecosystem that are on the coastline, tropics and subtropics only. They can't deal with frost. It's a tree-based ecosystem. The trees are special because they've got two tricks that other trees in general can't achieve. One is that they can tolerate a certain amount of salt, and the other is that they can be flooded or have water standing on top of their roots for a certain amount of time, a certain amount of each tidal cycle. And most trees can't cope with those two conditions. So these allow them to live in this intertidal zone between high water and low water as the tides coming in and out. And they form the basis, I suppose, the keystone species of a complicated, very valuable, hugely productive ecosystem that really helps local coastal people to survive, to provide food security, so there's always something to eat, provide protection from waves, from winds, from tsunamis, from tropical storms and cyclones and so on, and give us other sort of benefits as well as the normal sort of forest benefits of wood to build a house with, palm leaves to produce a roof over your head, wood to construct with or cook your rice on, etc., etc. So they're hugely valuable ecosystems. I think most of all, if you're in a community in a country that doesn't have an awful lot of money, these ecosystems really help the poorest in a community most of all. The individuals or the families that have fewest assets, there's always food, shrimp, crab, fish within these mangroves, and they provide all the sort of necessary materials to survive. And so that's why they're incredibly valuable.
Amazing. And mangroves, you've mentioned they're quite a unique ecosystem, and I wanted to know, where internationally are mangroves mostly found? Where can people go to regions that have mangroves and see them themselves?
Largely tropics and subtropics, so around the center of the planet. The most, I suppose, interesting, dare I say it, from a scientific point of view is Southeast Asia. There seem to be more species and more of them. Indonesia has the most mangroves anywhere in the world, but you can go to Florida. There are mangroves in Florida and the Caribbean and South America. There's plenty West Coast, East Coast, Africa, and Southeast Asia. So that part of the world, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, not Cambodia because it's landlocked, but those parts of the world, even actually Japan in its southern islands in Okinawa has mangroves.
For people located outside of those regions, why should they care about mangroves? What role do they play in environmental as well as human well-being?
So there's a lot of interest in mangroves from a carbon storage point of view. They sequester, take in and absorb or use a lot of carbon that they then store permanently within the ecosystem if they're not disturbed. It's much more effective than tropical rainforest and other forms of forest, because what the mangroves are doing are taking the carbon in terms of CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is a global greenhouse gas, so that affects everybody. The climate, the global warming affects everybody. They take CO2 out of the air and use it to produce roots and leaves and flowers and fruits and so on. But the real difference is that carbon is then stored in the soil. And as it's often underwater or saturated or under the soil, it tends to break down very slowly or indeed not at all. So that carbon, given time and not being disturbed, builds up and builds up and builds up. So 50, 60, 80% of the carbon in a mangrove ecosystem is in the soil rather than in the trees, and will stay there locked up if the ground is not, the land is not converted for some other. That's in contrast to somewhere like, say, a tropical rainforest, where the soil is very thin and it's quite acidic, and the nutrients in the carbon are all recycled. But it's not building up, it's not building up, it's not building up. Yes, there are huge trees, absolutely. But when they fall over, then they just decompose, and the CO2, the carbon is released back into the atmosphere as CO2 eventually, as these trees and leaves and flowers and stuff degrade. But in mangroves, that carbon is stored in the soil and it builds up over time. So even though I think it's 0.5% of the land area of the world is mangrove, the storage of carbon is very intense within those areas. And so that's another reason why they're really interesting.
Incredible. So they have this really unique system that really sets them apart from other forestry that we can find globally. Now, the name Mangrove Action Project, it suggests a focus on active intervention. What is that intervention? How would you summarize what your mission is, and what methods do you go about to do your work, and how would you explain that to the people listening here today?
It's got to be said, it's not a very good name. It isn't a very good name. In 1992, founder Alfredo Cuarto joined as part of the Earth Island Institute, his group, which he called Mangrove Action Project, because at the time it was actually a project. Since then, we have evolved into a sort of freestanding NGO, if you will. So the name has now stuck. The logo has now stuck. It's very recognizable within the industry, so we're not going to change it.
But you're stuck with it now.
It's a little bit misleading. I think, though, the founding and the reason for why Alfredo did it is important, because he was a traveling photojournalist. And he was in places like Thailand and Nigeria, and he was seeing a lot of mangrove destruction. And not only the ecosystem is going, but also the livelihoods of the people around it, who really relied on these ecosystems to be healthy and working well, were also being degraded because of losses, particularly in Nigeria because of oil pollution, and in Thailand because of shrimp aquaculture. So a lot of the mangroves were cleared and shrimp ponds were installed in their place in that same area. And these turn out to be not terribly sustainable, unfortunately. And so the local people were not helped by this shrimp aquaculture boom in the 1980s, 1990s, and so on. And so he started campaigning to try and save the mangroves and raise the awareness of just how valuable they are, the sort of things that we've been talking about before.
And was this internationally, or was this locally in Indonesia?
So this was globally. He's actually based in Port Angeles, north of Seattle, but he's been working globally. And so it's a very small, largely unpaid NGO. When the money ran out, they just worked for nothing, bless their hearts, that they would network these groups together who are trying to campaign for the preservation of mangroves. He would put these groups together with potential funders. He would put them together with potential academics who could help them with a bit of the science and the research and so on. And it was really a sort of campaigning push to try and preserve mangroves. At the same time, in the noughties, we started to do some training of how to understand these ecosystems better, and also how to restore them. But what really changed us and forced us to pivot, I suppose, was the Asian tsunami of 2004. Not so much the tsunami itself, but what happened afterwards. There was a vast amount of money put into all sorts of restoration projects around the area that was affected by that tsunami. And the outcomes of those restoration projects were terrible. The survivorship was very low. A lot of groups just planting willy-nilly one species wherever they thought they could plant. And a lot of this stuff failed, unfortunately. It was a shocking waste of money. We realized that there's a lot of science published about mangroves and mangrove ecology and mangrove science and so on already. That's fine. We understand how these systems work. And there's a lot of groups on the ground who are doing mangrove restoration and often a lot of other very good work. but there's no one taking this science, digesting it into a form that's much more understandable, because research papers are unbelievably dull to read. And then training the local groups, government officers, academics, other academics, NGOs, communities, into how to actually restore these ecosystems properly. And that's what Mangrove Action Project now does. We don't implement projects on the ground. We're this sort of catalytic trainer that helps groups go away from, move away from what is in effect sort of production of forestry, sort of trees as farming, if you will, approach, into thinking much more about how these ecosystem works and trying to restore the ecosystem, trying to recreate the conditions necessary for ecosystem restoration. And so that's what we do. And that's why I've just flown back from Fiji and I'm going to Tanzania next week, Tuesday, to run these sorts of workshops to help groups understand, particularly about choosing the appropriate site. Lots of places cannot be restored, even if it looks as though it's obvious sort of mangrove area. And then how to do it. That's what we focus on as an NGO.
Incredible. We're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Dominic Woodhouse from Mangrove Action Project. We just touched upon the foundations of what created the Mangrove Action Project and how it's changed over the past 30 years in the way that they look at mangrove conservation globally and the application of the NGO and how it applies its work. Now, Dominic, there's been a significant attention on blue carbon lately. Can you explain what blue carbon is and why mangroves are so critical in this context?
So blue carbon is the idea of carbon that is sequestered from or absorbed by plants that are in the marine space, so seagrass, salt marshes, mangroves, hence blue, and stored in the soil or stored in the actual plants themselves. And whether it is possible to monetize that, I get a mangrove to be restored, do a lot of restoration, and work out how much carbon is being stored, say, per unit area, and then whether you can sell that as a carbon credit onto the blue carbon credit markets. So that's the idea in principle. It's a way of trying to fund conservation, restoration, by paying for that ecosystem service, that service that the mangroves provide by taking carbon out of the atmosphere and permanently storing it here, in largely in the soil, but also in the trees. And that's the same for salt marshes and seagrass and other forms like that. So that's what blue carbon is about.
So a lot of this blue carbon work, how do you see it play out into the future of mangrove restoration and conservation? How do you see you guys best utilizing this process, or how do you want to see it play out globally?
I'm going to make a lot of enemies here, and I'm off most people's Christmas cards lists. So the idea, that the potential is that groups that want to promote, finance, help mangrove restoration can put money together to develop a project where an area that has been degraded, a mangrove area that's been degraded, can be restored. And as a result of those plants and trees coming back, the carbon credits, the resulting carbon credits, can be sold, and that pays for the restoration work. In principle, that's all good. In practice, it's actually really difficult, and there's lots of different reasons why. The first is the price of carbon is rather low at the moment. The price per ton is not very high, and so the economics are really difficult to make work. And if you start to include the price of, say, the expensive NGO staff who are, I mean, I know there's a lot of ruckus in the US, but a lot of these NGO people are incredibly well-versed experts, passionate about what they do, and as a result, you know, expensive people. So if you account for them, these projects are difficult to make economic sense. A lot of the people who are financing them are expecting a financial return. And I think that's just unrealistic in this space. It's just not, the market is not ready for it. The land tenure is often extremely difficult because you need to make sure that if you're going to do a blue carbon project, the trees stay in the ground and the carbon stays in the ground for 40 or 60 years. It's not just a question of, oh, some trees are coming back. That's great. And then forget about it. It's a long-term solution. I mean, I think most importantly, the communities have got to be front and center of this project. That if as outsiders, you guys, us, jump into an area and start doing mangrove restoration, communities are going to say, well, it's not our project. We don't really care about it. So we don't really care about what happens. And we're just going to cut the trees down when they're big enough to be useful. These projects need to be based around these coastal communities that live near these mangroves. They have to see it, feel it as their project that they have ownership over, and they will protect from their fellow villagers, from everyone else, and make sure that they thrive and grow and are maintained in a healthy, productive, valuable ecosystems. That's really difficult. That's a really difficult trick, because in some countries where poverty is widespread, local people have very few options to be able to survive. You've got to feed the family this evening. How do I cook my rice? How do I put money on the table tonight? It's not a question of nice long-term projects for 60 years. If we don't get this right, in some places, it's a question of life and death, literally life and death. How do you do that? You've got no other options around you. You're not getting any social security from your government. The local towns are too far away to go and get a job, say construction, road building, etc. So one of the very few options, if you don't have assets like nets or a boat, is to cut the trees down and turn it all into charcoal and sell it. So you've got to deal with that and get past that so the communities are A, fully aware of all the benefits of mangroves, and B, know that it's their project, and C, benefit from at least 50, 60, 70% of the income that comes from the sale of those carbon credits. So as they can improve, develop their village or communities and sort out sort of livelihood issues, etc. And arranging all that is incredibly difficult. It's slow. It takes great skill. It's easy to get it wrong. And that's why I think blue carbon projects are very difficult to manage.
It seems like it's immensely complex, and the foundations of the project sound very hopeful. And you've touched upon a lot of interesting things there regarding communities and their use of these projects and their ownership regarding them. And I'm super excited to jump into all these topics with you. I kind of want to know, you've gone through what has happened over mangroves in certain locations internationally over the past few decades, but what is currently threatening their survival?
All sorts of things. Good question. All sorts of things, and it varies by where you are. Some places there is still shrimp and fish aquaculture expansion, and that happens in the same intertidal zone between high water and low water where the mangroves exist. Other areas, it's urban development, just towns, villages, communities expanding. Sea level rise is quite site specific. Not everywhere is rising at the same area. Some places the sea level is falling, other places it's rising and rising very quickly. Mangroves have a very specific tolerance, preference to where they live relative to sea level. So if sea level rises, they want to also migrate back, probably an uphill, in order to be able to have that same level relative to sea level. If there is a sea wall or a community or a road or something right behind the mangrove, there's no space to migrate. They get squeezed in a sense, rather than everything you'll be able to migrate uphill. Pollution doesn't help. A lot of rivers have got a huge amount of nutrients, some nasty stuff in them. Overharvesting, just because of a lack of livelihood options. Cattle grazing will eat a lot of the natural regeneration. That's a particular problem in East Coast Africa. Road building seems to be an issue in South America. I never really quite understood why, but a lot of roads are then built through the mangroves, which in itself cannot necessarily be a problem. It's cutting the hydrology off from one side to the other side because of a solid road and its foundations that causes the problem, and one side's going to die off. So it really varies by location. There's also, I think, a lack of appreciation of just how valuable these ecosystems are. And then just the reality of political life, I suppose, that at the end of the day, it's one ministry fighting it out against another ministry. So the Forest Department or the Environment Department wants to protect the mangroves, but Fisheries Department or Road Building or Highways or some other ministry wants to do something else with that same land, build a port, for example. And the challenge is that from a government point of view, mangroves don't produce any income. They're just there. They look after people. They're super valuable. There's no money coming back from them. But a port or a factory produces taxes, makes jobs. And so that environmental economics, another hideous phrase, is
I'm
often
hearing mangroves. So many intersections of problems. You're talking about governmental intersections of problems. You're talking about environmental intersections of problems. There is a lot of crowding going along around mangroves in every possible sense. Generally, there has been a lot of talk about mangrove planting efforts globally. Even when I was at COP28, we took a day out to go and plant some mangroves. What challenges and limitations do these efforts face?
Oh, challenge with planting is that it tends to go onto a site that is not necessarily that suitable. It tends to be done in rows and straight lines, which in itself is not a problem. It does actually have a technical problem later on. But in order to preserve these nice straight lines, it tends to take planting into areas that shouldn't be planted. And there's quite a skill in appropriate site selection where mangroves should be. And unfortunately, land tenure is often working against you. So if you go into some of these communities and say, I'd like to restore some mangrove or plant some mangrove, then where do you do it? They will say, well, all this land is divided up between the different families. So there isn't anything available. And that starts to take you into this whole land tenure problem. So a lot of these projects where they go mangrove planting then go out onto unsuitable sites like mudflats. Sorry to get so technical for a second, but between high water and low water, in general, mudflat starts from about mean sea level, somewhere in the middle, and goes down to low water. That's an area that tends to be uncontested because no one's trying to stake a claim to that. It's not somewhere where there's a land tenure issue. And a lot of planting is done in those mudflats. Because it's easy, because they're open, because you can photograph a huge project, because you can mark out your GPS corners and send it back to head office and say, we've hit our area target. But they're unsuitable for mangrove ecosystems. The challenge is that right at the beginning, you're saying, why are mangroves special? Mangroves are special because they can tolerate salt, sure, and they can tolerate being flooded, having very wet soil for a lot of time. But there's a limit to how much they can tolerate. And if you go too far down the slope, and so these ecosystems are inundated for too much of each tidal cycle, then they can't cope with that. And that becomes very stressful and they die. The second thing is that they tend to use the wrong species in those sites. And again, I'm sorry to be technical to you. So within the mangrove ecosystem, there are some species that like to be high and dry, basically almost at high water, get wet twice a month, 10 minutes only, and they want to basically keep their roots dry for most of the time. So they like free-draining sandy soil and they're right at the back. And then there's some species that are happy to be somewhere in the middle. And there's some species that are happy to be at the front of the mangrove ecosystem, get wet twice a day, 20-30% of each tidal cycle, heavy wet clay, it's all good. The ones that are easy to handle, because they produce seeds that look like pencils, are somewhere in the middle. And what often happens is that these are planted far too low down on this coastline from high water to low water. And so they really struggle in an area where they shouldn't be. And so that often leads to these huge planting programs that you read in the media not working out terribly successfully. And that's why we're saying that we try and move people away from just planting projects, particularly of single species, because they lack biodiversity, and towards thinking about this whole thing as an ecosystem and restoring the ecosystem and focusing on appropriate site choice and appropriate hydrology, which includes the water coming in, but also the drainage of the water going out. So as the soil, the air can get back into the soil and other sort of factors. And then what species like to live in which place, and getting that sort of decision right.
So you've touched upon there a lot about the mangrove ecosystems, and I have a bit of a compound question here. How is climate change affecting the mangrove ecosystems? I know you've spoken about their locality to sea level and mangroves migrating, as well as the intersection of biodiversity there. But I want to know here in this stage, what is the Mangrove Action Project? How is it approaching restoration differently to ensure long-term success? And what steps is Mangrove Action Project taking to address environmental impacts?
So we're a very small NGO, 10 people. So we really stick to our knitting of mangroves and mangrove ecology, mangrove restoration. We partner with a lot of fantastic NGOs that work more broadly, and they're set up to do it, like WWF and the Nature Conservancy and Conservation International, and so on. All fantastic groups. So we partner with them, but we sort of stick to our knitting, if you will. From our point of view, when we go training, we try and make sure that the participants that we're training really understand the likely implications of climate change. And that varies a little bit around the world. But from a mangrove point of view, from a sort of nerdery point of view, you can see I can bring dinner parties to a halt like that and never get invited back. So what it really means from our point of view is bigger, more violent storms. And so that also causes potentially more erosion and a change in the rainfall patterns. So in a lot of mangrove ecosystems, what's important is a mix of fresh water coming down the river and seawater coming in. And that mixed brackish water allows a lot of different species to survive. If the salinity increases because there's a lack of freshwater input, then fewer and fewer of the mangrove species can tolerate an increasing level of salinity. And so what we try and make sure is that the people we're training really understand these sort of implications of climate change, and then focus on really successful biodiverse mangrove restoration, and also trying to make sure that the mangroves that exist currently in their areas, in their communities, are as healthy and as functional as possible. So the hydrology works very well. There's the full lineup of species present in their country, in their region, that should be there for all the usual sort of biodiversity reasons. And that the soil is drained well, the hydrology works well, the natural regeneration is there, the forest structure is appropriate, so lots of juveniles are around ready to take over if the big trees fall over for some reason or are used or hit by lightning. And so these things are as healthy as possible. And that is the only way that we can really make mangroves as resilient to climate change as possible.
Incredible. On that note, we'll be right back after this short break.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Dominic Woodhouse from Mangrove Action Project. We've just touched upon the steps that Mangrove Action Project are taking to address not only environmental impacts, but also to ensure long-term successes in mangrove restoration. Now, Dominic, from what I've researched, Mangrove Action Project uses a lot of community-based ecological mangrove restoration approaches. Can you explain how these approaches directly and effectively restore and conserve mangrove ecosystems? But how does Mangrove Action Project blend the traditional knowledge as well as modern conservation practices?
So you touched on the process in which we teach. So what we teach is a process called community-based ecological mangrove restoration. And I'll take you through the process, and I think it becomes evident as to how we then include local knowledge. When we're training, we tend to train local NGOs or international NGOs, government forest officers, academics, and some community groups. And we take them through this process. What we hope is that this step-by-step approach is a good way of approaching any mangrove restoration anywhere. The first stage is this community engagement that particularly outside NGOs need to spend a lot of time engaging, working with local communities to find out what they need, what they know, the quality of the leadership, who owns the land, and start to build trust and a relationship with these groups. And this is where we start to work from making it an outside project funded by IUCN or the UN or whoever. And it starts to evolve into a community-led project that outsiders like MAP and so on are acting as technical advice and encouragement, sort of cheerleaders and so on. But it quickly becomes their project. In the process of working with the communities, building the trust, talking with them, finding out what they need, finding out the livelihood needs, etc., then we will look at various sites that we want to try and restore. And we will discuss the science from the outside point of view, the local knowledge from their point of view. And they will tell us what they understand. We will tell them what we understand, and we blend that together. Mm-hmm. So the science has the advantage of science, repeated testing over time, the whole point of science. But they have long-term observership of a site, which we don't have. We will be
absolutely
on site for not particularly a long time. They will see things that change over the days, the weeks, the months, the years. One good example that I remember talking about is that we might come and see a site and it's got some particular features. We don't necessarily understand what's going on. The local community will say, well, actually, at the end of the dry season, there's no grazing for cattle inland, and all these cattle are pushed into the back of the mangroves to feed because there's nothing else to eat. So the reason why you see no natural regeneration here is that for about 3 or 4 weeks, it's full of goats, cows, everything.
It's all been grazed upon.
And it's all been woofed. Absolutely. It's all been eaten. And that's why there's no natural regeneration. It's not a parasite. It's not a fungus. It's not someone cutting. It's not, you know, any other activity. So it's
because as that external organization, you can't be monitoring all of these sites remotely consistently. So having these community connections is incredibly important.
Absolutely. And this is where we then start to talk about, okay, if you want this to be sustainable, we have to deal with, you know, together, we have to deal with this grazing issue and work to a solution. Again, we can't come in and impose or say, right, we've got to fence it all off, because, you know, that's 1970s national parks protection. We know that doesn't work. If, you know, for anyone who's sort of an academic bent, Ostrom and Agrawal and so on are writers on this, and they demonstrate that this sort of stuff doesn't work. And then the rest of the process, sorry, when we call it community-based, my colleague Jim Enright is always at pains to say that it's community stakeholders, but also other stakeholders that are interested in the mangroves. And that might be all sorts of other different groups like local government units and local companies and so on. So with the community and using it as an opportunity to build capacity, we need to do a ton of research, biophysical on the site, what's happened to it, why is it not naturally regenerating, how's the hydrology working, what species is there, what species could be there, etc. But also social. What's the quality of the village leadership like, or community leadership like? If the leadership is poor, it's never going to work. No project's going to work. If the leadership is great, then they can run these projects and have the social capacity to be able to make sure that disagreements are ironed out internally, etc.
How do you go about establishing positive relationships here, though?
So I suppose from our point of view, we always work through a local NGO. We never sort of jump into a community sort of unbidden. So we're always working through a local group, and they tend to have already developed a very positive
relationship. Amazing.
And also I found, actually doing my own agonizing PhD research, that there's always this common ground. I know I'm some exhausted bald white guy from London, and they think, well, I'm just a sort of alien. But then we start talking about mangroves, and it becomes clear that I know about mangroves and they know about mangroves, so we've got this common ground already. And so you start chatting and say, you know, what you've been doing and how's it working and so on, and there's instantly a bond. And then they get past the fact that some British person is interested in mangroves when we don't have mangroves in the UK.
Yeah,
how does that work?
They're like, how does this affect you? Like, why are you here? Awesome. And you're like, well, actually, I'm very passionate.
Absolutely. And then, why don't you have a family? Well, I'm too lazy. And, you know, and why are you doing a PhD? How could you be so dumb as to do a PhD? Well, that's a really good question. And yeah, and all sorts of other sort of things. So you get past all that. And there's this common ground. And I think you have to work with the sort of coalition of the willing within a community. Not everybody's interested in mangroves in a community that lives near the mangroves. Some of them just go into town and have a job in town. And that's fine. You find the people who are actually interested in it. Very quickly, you can work out how much they know or not, and they understand how much we know or not. So there's this sort of common ground, this sort of common desire. And a lot of them have either understand from a previous disaster or just generally that these ecosystems are really valuable, and any opportunities to bring them back, and it's all good. So a terrible example is Cyclone Nargis that hits Myanmar in 2008, if I remember correctly. 20,000 people disappeared, and another 30,000 died, and another 30,000 are allegedly missing, obviously disappeared. And largely because Myanmar, which is one of the countries that is deforesting its mangroves faster than almost anywhere else, has cleared a lot of mangroves in order to turn that land into rice paddies for rice self-sufficiency. And so they took a Category 5 hurricane in the face with no protection of trees or, you know, mangrove forests, and disappeared. Terrible, terrible, terrible example. So a lot of people understood events like that and thought, okay, wow, I really want to have half a mile of mangroves between me and a Category 5 coming inland, because
self-preservation.
Absolutely. So in terms of the process that we take groups through, just very briefly, so that community engagement is absolutely central. Building capacity, building trust, understanding what they know, they understanding what we know. And so we do a lot of research, biophysical and social. We then agree on what the objectives are for a restoration project, because some sites are quite difficult. If it's very saline, there's a limit to what you can do, for example. We make sure that participants are as transparent as possible with the project, particularly about the money. And then we work out what we should be doing, the implementation, both biophysical and social. There might be social programs that need to be put in place, like alternative or supplementary livelihoods, to try and move people away from cutting mangroves as a livelihood and towards something that is nature positive, mangrove positive, rather than mangrove destructive. And then agree how we're going to monitor this restoration. And if we haven't quite got the implementation right, like, for example, improving hydrology, then monitor to see that we haven't quite got it right, and then amend and sort of that adaptive management. So that's the sort of process that we teach, the CBMR process, if you will. And what we hope is that doing things like that research, social and biophysical, that the right sites will be picked. But crucially, the capacity stays within the community and stays within the participants. It can't be us coming in and say, do this because I say so, and I've got no hair and I come from London and I'm very white. It's got to be something.
Yeah, they have to have that ownership. It can't be something that's absolutely externally managed by an external organization that comes in and out, because there's no autonomy there. That's completely understandable.
Totally.
On that note, when you were just talking about these processes, and you've spoken about how Mangrove Action Project is quite a small team, and then you're partnering with all these local NGOs to have that intersection to these communities. Do you have hopes of expansion of this model? Because I've spoken to a lot of NGOs, I've worked with a lot of NGOs internationally as well, and I think this model is quite unique, and I think there's a lot of hope in this sphere about having this sort of intersection and this connecting node between those that are coming in with higher functionality and able to upskill and train and connect with these communities through an organization that has the ability to do that.
So we're sort of small cog in a much bigger process of working with these much bigger communities that have the capacity and the resources and the reach.
Yeah. You mentioned you partnered with some international organizations as well to help support you. Yeah.
So there is something called the Global Mangrove Alliance, as it sounds, and it's the big NGOs and a lot of other smaller NGOs that are working together to try and halt loss and restore half of what we've lost since 96, because actually the mapping and the data becomes much better at that point. And then make sure that a good percentage, a target is 80, of the mangrove ecosystem within a country is in some form of protection, some form of protected area, so it cannot be turned into a port or something else. So we work with these groups. Building the capacity is only one small element of it. There's all sorts of other work that needs to be done, and these other groups are much better at doing that than we are. So for example, making sure that countries have very good nature positive, mangrove positive policy and conservation policy in place is something that often needs to happen at a very high level. And there are much better groups, particularly the Nature Conservancy, I think, and IUCN are very good at working at that sort of level, intergovernmental level, to make sure that those are in place. A lot of those NGOs that I've mentioned and our partner NGOs within the Global Mangrove Alliance, which is about 100 or so, are doing some very nice work on the ground. And what's also needed is joined up work, as you might imagine.
Yes, I was actually just going to touch upon that. When it comes to all of these organizations, how do you figure out what, I don't want to use the term territory, but I guess I mean what sort of implications would be had if there's a section where you both want to apply your work, or there's a let's say one project is already working in an area and you might come in and say, actually, the way that we think we could do this would be better, for example. How do you guys go about moments like that occur?
Part of the function of the Global Mangrove Alliance is to try and make these NGOs work better together. Sometimes it's possible, sometimes it's not. Some countries are just innately more competitive between one NGO and another. We are all fighting for funding, and that's really where the competition comes down for. Not so much turf and physical area, but actually just sort of funding. There is potentially that sort of competition. But from our experience, a lot of these groups, and particularly the big NGOs, work pretty well together. For the Mangrove Alliance, they've spent 2018, 2019, 2020 working out how to work well together as an alliance. So now we work very well as a global team. MAP is part of this global team of the Global Mangrove Alliance. And I think there's a lot of cooperation between these groups. There's also a lot of respect between these NGOs, particularly the individuals as part of the Global Mangrove Alliance, because they are really great, very knowledgeable, highly experienced, highly qualified, passionate people who've been in this space for a while. So you respect their opinion and you listen to them. And it's all good.
You've mentioned there was competition for fundraising. I would love to know how you think listeners, what help can they bring to Mangrove Action Project, the Global Alliance, or whether directly your organizations, and what actionable steps can they take towards mangrove conservation?
I think I would broaden that question. If people want to support an area, there's so many things that need help. And obviously, we've just had a very narrow conversation about mangroves, but you can broaden it out into all sorts of areas. What I'd suggest is focus on what you're passionate about first, and then get into it and do a bit of reading and find out a bit about it. And you can clear that. You can. Yeah, it's pretty clear that
Dominic's talking about his guide to getting a PhD now.
Yeah. Don't do that. Don't do that. I did meet someone who's doing a second PhD. I just can't imagine. Okay, one is crazy. Two, didn't Oscar Wilde say something about that? I'd suggest get into an area and really sort of research it, so you know who's playing, what the issues are. So it can be maternal health, or it can be education, or training teachers, or mangroves, or you know whatever. But find an area that you're really passionate about and start to focus on what area of that needs support and what you might, how you might want to encourage that. See, there is some sort of financial support. Maybe you give £5 a month to a particular group. That's great. That's all very valuable. But you might want to get further into it in order to understand more about the issues and what's going on and what needs support and so on.
If someone's interested and really passionate about mangroves, are they able to volunteer with the Mangrove Action Project?
Not so much volunteer, because what we do needs sort of very specialized skill set in terms of training.
Okay. Highly skilled individuals then.
So I'm having an interesting time recruiting for one more trainer, and I just essentially need a clone of my fantastic colleague, Dr. Laura Mickey, who's got 15 years experience in mangroves, can travel anywhere, presents really well, teaches very well, and I just want another one of hers. I just want to bud her off in a petri dish.
If someone's listening and you have those skill sets, Dominic is looking for...
One more trainer. So we have a slightly different cost base because we don't run projects on the ground. And so we try and move groups away from, if we give you $10,000, would you plant 10,000 trees? It's much more to do with conserving these ecosystems. But actually, from our point of view, it's getting into those sites in the first place. One of the things that we've learned is that you can produce all these manuals, et cetera, and there's a lot of them. But the groups that are doing the restoration don't read manuals. And I know this gets me off everyone else's Christmas card list, because a lot of people who produce manuals and they're very proud of them. And they are very good, but they're not being read. You have to get in their faces, on their sites, take them through their own mangroves and say, this is why this is doing what it's doing. This is an area that we can restore. This is an area we can't restore, and this is why. Mm-hmm. And so it's that funding to get us onto those sites and all the other things that we do. Photography competition, children's art competition, outreach. We do a lot of advice for NGOs who get in contact with us, and we spend time on Zoom looking at sites and ground level photos. That's the sort of thing that costs us, and that's what we need to fund. But from a listener point of view, I'd suggest follow your passion, find something, focus on that. I think it'd be much more rewarding as something to support. That if you're into children's education or saving children or whatever, then get into that. The funders that fund us, we've got three or four family foundations who have just been incredibly supportive, and they've done a lot of homework before they call us at all. They've read all sorts of stuff. They've narrowed down into an area they are passionate about. They really know why they're talking to us. They know that planting doesn't work. They understand CBMR. And so they call us and say, how can we help? And that's, from a funder's point of view, a big family foundation. That's the question. It's not, we're going to give you money, we're going to tell you what to do. It's, you know what you're doing. Here's some money. What do you need? What support do you need? That's the right approach from a sort of funder's point of view. And keeping the monitoring and the reporting light, because do you want us to get out there and do what we do well? Or do you want us to sit there and write reports all day? Because it's not very productive. And no one reads those either.
All this work being done, no one's reading any of it.
No, but it looks great in the cupboard.
Dominic, I'd love for you to just take us through what has been your proudest achievement in doing work for the Mangrove Action Project, let's say over the past 5 years. Any specific restoration success story or community transformation that has stood out for you?
I think, if I may, an internal and external. An internal is that the NGO has really transformed since 2020. We've focused very much more on restoration training. We've brought some funders in, and the NGO is in a very different state, particularly financially, from the time that I took over. And that I'm incredibly proud about. The shows that we show, I keep calling it a show, I mustn't do that. A workshop that we put on, I think, are really great. We get a lot of very positive feedback from the people that we train. We change their behavior. That's the key. We change their behavior after the week or 10 days that we spent together. And that makes me hugely, hugely proud of the team and what we do and my colleagues. An example that really, that we've actually, Leo, Tom, our fantastic filmmaker, has documented, if anyone's interested, on YouTube. If you get onto YouTube and look at Return of the Mangroves, it's a really nice example of what we try and do. So my colleagues, Jim Enright and Alfredo Cuarto, did a workshop in El Salvador in 2011, if I remember correctly. Big area had died off, and it's died off, and they've been planting and planting, and everything's been dying. And the training made them understand that the problem was the blocked hydrology, that a lot of sediment was coming down from inland, from agriculture, and I think actually also some tectonic shifts. And all the hydrology had been blocked. So the community got that, and they dug by hand themselves, with no financing, about 4 kilometers of channel. And it's about 2 or 3 meters wide. It's no mean feat. And then just let natural regeneration do its thing. And these things have come back, and we've documented what it now looks like, as in you meet a tall, dark, dense, perfect forest that works really well. And the productivity that comes from that, the fish, the crab, the shrimp increases, are fantastic. And I think as an achievement for MAP, that's our proudest sort of external achievement, if you will.
That sounds amazing. I've already had a good look at that video on YouTube, and it was an amazing watch. And I hope that people listening here today take the time to check it out. I guess just to wrap up here, Dominic, I'd love to know what one key takeaway you'd have for our listeners to remember about the interconnection of coastal communities, mangroves, and climate resistance. And I would love to for you to go through to people about how they can find out more about MAP, as well as what your final message of hope would be for conservation worldwide.
It's a little remote because they're tropics and subtropics, so I would suggest just hold on to the fact that mangroves are incredibly valuable and worth protecting. Taking a step back again, I would suggest if you want to support environmental causes, get in and find your passion, from, I don't know, rewilding golf courses to mangrove conservation. There's a lot of information on our website, but also there are many other websites and so on that talk about mangroves and why they're valuable, the works have been doing that's going on in different communities.
And the websites are?
mangroveactionproject.org, as you'd imagine, all one word. And my hope for the mangrove world is that I think the Global Mangrove Alliance is doing some fantastic work, but the wider intergovernmental community, and particularly at events like COP, which I know you've been to, are starting to really wake up to just how valuable wetlands and mangroves specifically, but also seagrass and salt marshes, how valuable they are. It's not vegetation by default. It's not just sort of green stuff and trees just by a sort of random chance. These are ecosystems that are very complicated, but also incredibly valuable. And it's great to see that policymakers, ministers, and so on are getting that message. And so there is a effort to conserve them, to protect them, that perhaps 10 years ago there wasn't. And so that's, I think, really hopeful for me.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Dominic. You gave me such incredible insight into the world of mangroves. And thank you all for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.